Witchlit is on a summer hiatus while we settle into our new Witchlit HQ. And rather than leave a blank space in the feed, we're taking the old TV network approach and bringing you some summer reruns from our first two seasons. Today's re-release is my conversation with Zoe Howe. We talked about her then new book, Witchful Thinking. I would highly recommend her other books if you are at all into rock and roll biographies and history. She's written about Stevie Nicks, The Jam, The Slits, Florence and the Machine, Polystyrene, The Jesus and Mary Chain, and she's written a novel, Shine On, Marquee Moon, which was shortlisted for the Virginia Prize for Fiction. Welcome to Witchlit, a podcast where we talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, fiction author, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Zoe Howe is an internationally published author, artist, musician, and solitary witch based in East Anglia, UK. She has 13 books published, including her best-selling biography of rock's own witchy woman, Stevie Nicks, Visions, Dreams, and Rumors. Howe is a regular host on the award-winning UK station Soho Radio with her popular The Rock and Roll Witch, and she has also appeared on UK TV and radio outlets including the BBC and Sky Arts. Her work has been acclaimed by publications including The Guardian, The Sunday Express, Teen Vogue, Rolling Stone, and elsewhere. She is currently the Royal Literary Fund Writing Fellow at Newnham College, University of Cambridge. Her new book, Witchful Thinking, is available from Llewellyn in the U.S. in April 2022. Zoe Howe, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you on. We chatted a little bit before and I've already gushed about your book, so now we get to talk about it some more.
Hurrah!
So our first question for everybody is, why write? I know you're a triple threat because you've got a lot else going on, so why write in addition to make music and art?
Well, writing, that's such a big question. Just two words, but it's a big question. Why write? There are so many reasons why one should write and why I can't not write. But I think the first thing that springs to mind really is that sense of getting your thoughts out of your head and onto the page, physicalizing your thoughts. And that can work on a number of levels, you know, just from the point of view of journaling, processing your thoughts from the day. And it's obviously used as a technique in therapy for a very good reason, because once we get our thoughts out onto that page, you know, they become a little bit easier to control and to understand. I think writing gives us perspective. So even if it's just for our eyes only, that's a powerful thing. And I find myself, you know, everything gets written down. I love lists and, you know, notebooks get filled very quickly. And, you know, that to me, it's important for mental health and it's important for, you know, recording special things because we think, you know, my mum always says that we think we'll remember these things, but we don't. She says, write it all down, you know, whenever there's a synchronicity or something really magical happens or something, you know, maybe connected with spirit happens. We think we'll remember these things because they're so fab and they quite quickly fly away. So I write for that reason as well, to record. I always say I'll look back and see if there's any patterns forming, but I never do. I don't like looking back. I just look forward, but it'd probably be quite interesting if I did do that. But also from the point of view, you know, you think of magical journals and books of shadows. That's something that I've always, you know, I've always maintained throughout my life, and I find it not only interesting from a point of view of recording what I'm doing, setting out and organizing my thoughts maybe for a ritual or maybe a new moon list or whatever, but I feel that just the writing of it is a magical act, making something that was once non-physical technically physical. And I think, you know, it's interesting, you often hear people who are not necessarily magical practitioners saying, oh, you know, I wrote down a list of things that I wanted in the house that I wanted to buy, or, you know, or my perfect partner. And, you know, once that came into my life, I found that list again by accident and it fulfilled all of those things. And so I think, you know, even if you don't realize it or look at it that way, there is something very powerful about writing down our words. And I think with that in mind, we have to be very careful about what we write. And I think, you know, this is a really long rambling answer, but, you know, that's why I think things like gratitude journals are so great, because I used to journal and I used to get, you know, just get everything out and find myself kind of really going over certain things that maybe weren't so great. But by keeping a gratitude journal as well, I shift the focus and the kind of magnifying glass goes on what's great and about my day. And you might sort of sit down at the end of a day and think, well, nothing really happened, or well, certainly nothing worthy of being written down happened. But once you start, more things start coming to mind, and you'll think, I'll just write three things down, but you'll quickly write 10 things down and think, mm-hmm. wow, actually some really great things happened today that I would have just ignored, because we're human beings and we tend to, you know, focus on the negative. So I think for lots of reasons, writing is really important for everybody, not just people who call themselves writers.
Yeah, I like that you touched on, like, that writing can also be a magical act in and of itself. I think that's important to kind of draw underline under.
Totally.
Yeah. So what has your journey to public? I mean, like, you know, in the intro, you've published several books already, you know, rock and roll biographies, and you've just done a ton of writing in that field. But what was your journey to getting published like?
Well, it's funny because I didn't really have any contacts in that world particularly, but I think it was my first book, which was a biography of The Slits, the female punk band The Slits, came out in 2009. And really, I just wanted to, I was already kind of writing here and there, but I just thought, wow, you know, they really deserve a book. Why haven't they got a book? All the male bands have got books galore, you know. So I was like, what's going on there? So I've thought, well, you know, no one's doing this. In true punk DIY style, I'm gonna do it. And I got in touch with the band members and sort of, you know, lots of people, and it sort of got the ball rolling. And I would probably, you know, been working on it for about 6 months before I'd even really thought about maybe I should speak to a publisher. So, and I just thought, well, I don't know where to start. I haven't got any, you know, I don't know anyone. And no, certainly no one knew me. But it was one of those sort of magical things, weirdly, of just, it was a sort of an idea whose time had come, mm-hmm. and everything kind of aligned to just kind of work out. So one of the members of The Slits actually said, oh, do you know a publisher called Omnibus Press? And of course, little did I realise at the time, they're like the biggest music book publisher in the world. And she said, oh, well, my neighbour works for them. Maybe you should sort of speak to her and she can connect you with the commissioning editor. I was like, oh, okay. And so, you know, and it was just lovely that kind of came through one of The Slits, you know, as she came, it was so kind of localised, all these things happening, quite unlikely things. And so it wasn't entirely straightforward, but it was like these things were kind of put into my path, and it's like, you know, make of this what you will, you know, this, now it's down to you to kind of do the right thing. So I did send out a pitch to Omnibus, and I sent out a pitch to another publisher as well. And they were interested, but the editor was having some ill health problems and it didn't quite align. Mm-hmm. But Omnibus, they went quiet, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to try again. And it turned out that, you know, the person who'd been sent the email just hadn't received it or read it properly or whatever. So there's a little lesson there. Always try twice, you know.
Yes.
Don't just think, oh, it's just they don't want it, so I'll ignore it. Just always persist in a nice way. And so this commissioning editor, Chris Charlesworth, responded and was like, oh, yeah, let's have a chat. And, you know, so it just sort of grew from there. And I felt very fortunate that he agreed to put this book out, which was really quite niche at the time. You know, not that many people were really celebrating The Slits as I felt that they should be. Mm-hmm. And Omnibus were quite a mainstream publisher. So I thought, you know, they might not really feel that this is going to sell a lot of copies for them. But and lo and behold, it didn't. But the fact is, it was really cool of them to take a chance on me and take a chance on The Slits. And it was a critical success and had lots of lovely effects in other ways too. And from then on, they said, well, you know, what else do you want to do? Would you like to do another book? Obviously, the answer is yes. So off we went, you know. So Omnibus have been really good to me. I've done lots of books with them. The book you mentioned about Stevie Nicks, that came out with Omnibus. I've worked with other publishers as well. on different books. And of course, you know, Witchful Thinking came out with is coming out with Llewellyn, which is such an honor. So it was one of those things that just kind of once it got going, it snowballed. And I think you know, I was just fortunate that it was a relationship that seemed to work, and they were happy to work with me again. And then, you know, as you know, things kind of snowball, don't they?
Mm-hmm. I had this like very image, very vivid image when you were talking about, oh, and one of the band members lived next door to like this, almost like a tarot card fool's journey of getting published.
Yes, that's like, perfect.
I was like, oh, that totally, like, you know, just the right door opens at the right time. You know,
isn't that, yeah, you're right. That's such a good way of describing it. That's perfect. Because it's like, you know, very much a sense of, I don't know what I'm doing. There's no, you know, there's no manual for this. Or if there is, certainly no one's shown it to me. But this needs to happen. And this is really exciting. And it's an adventure. And, you know, what can I say? It's a book about a punk band. Mm-hmm. So you go about it in a punk way. And you don't sort of plan sort of 5 years ahead. Mm-hmm. You just go for it and see what happens, and you know, jump and the net will appear, and it'll take you to some interesting places. So that's such a great analogy that you use, the fool's, you know, the tarot card of the fool, because yeah, that just sums it up really.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I'm just happy that a book about the Slits is out there. I have a very soft spot in my heart for punk, and they deserve to have a book about them, especially a book done in a punk DIY way. So
yes, yeah, absolutely. Or someone, when it came out, the writer Chris Needs, who's a wonderful chap and a very important figure in the punk scene and beyond, reviewed it very kindly, and he put it very well. He said it was written in true Slit style, you know, in true kamikaze Slits fashion. I was like, yes, it did feel like, you know, I just threw myself in and just, you know, hope that there'll be a, you know, something not too hard to land on at the end of it.
Excellent. So that's now cool. That you've published and you're, mm-hmm. you know, kind of branching out with this new book.
Yeah.
Like, how much of your life is writing? I mean, do you introduce yourself to people as a writer first, or?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, that you know, it's always difficult to kind of quantify when you do things in the arts, and especially in England, the arts, unfortunately, even though I would say art and culture and music, you know, they are our greatest exports, they're still not really valued and taken as seriously as they should be, or given the support that they need. They're taken for granted very much over here. So, you know, I think a lot of artists of every stripe struggle with how to kind of, you know, is like, is it okay to call myself an artist? Is it okay? But, you know, I just think, well, okay, I can honestly say that I do earn my living through doing this. So I don't feel like I'm being pompous by saying I'm a writer, because that is what I do. So yeah, most of my working life is writing in different capacities. And my current work with Newnham College is working with students on their writing, and helping them kind of develop, you know, the sort of flow, I suppose, and smooth expression, and all the rest of it. So, so yeah, I mean, writing books has brought me there as well, which is a very special thing.
So, writing is a mystery of your life. So, what does your perfect writing day look like? Do you have rituals around writing? Do you have to set up the scene, or are you not precious about it?
Well, let me think. That's a good question, because, yeah, I probably do. I mean, I feel like I go about things in a very chaotic way, but I think we're creatures of habit, aren't we? So we probably do have more routine, even when we're doing things in a very kind of natural, spontaneous way, than we think. Generally speaking, after I've sort of, you know, I've got up and I've had my coffee and I've done my sort of daily kind of meditation and devotionals and all the rest of it, then I will, you know, I'll set up my desk and have a little candle burning. And so it is, I suppose it is like a ritual, you know, it all is like a ritual, right down to answering my emails, actually. So I do that first, because I think, get that out of the way, then I can just give my brain over to sort of a more kind of creative flow, I suppose, because once I get into that, I find it very hard to get out and do anything like answering an email for the rest of the day. So that has to happen first. But once that's done, And my mind is sort of clear, and I have a cup of tea, and then I plan. I suppose it depends very much on the project that I'm working on. So the most recent one I've been working on is a book called The Art of Punk, which is it came out 10 years ago, but I was given the lovely job of curating the update. So looking at kind of punk art and graphics. And how they've developed over the past 10 years. And so the rest of the book is obviously goes right from the ground zero of punk. So mm-hmm. I've just kind of been updating it, which has been a really interesting project. But of course, you have to plan it in a certain way because you're dealing with visuals as well as conjuring up words. So it very much depends on the project. But I try to make sure I've got a bit of a plan. I always have a notepad next to me so I can write things down longhand as well as... use the computer. So I just find that's another thing, going back to what we said before about the journaling and stuff. Everyone's got to do things the way that's right for them, but for me, I find it really important to do it longhand. When I'm specifically writing for magical purposes or just getting my thoughts out, or gratitude journaling or whatever, I find it feels much more real if I do it with a pen or a pencil and paper. It feels much more of a physical, tangible thing. And then you can kind of work with that as well. You can burn it or you can do whatever, probably best not to sort of burn your laptop if you've written a list of things that you want to get rid of at the Dark Moon or something like that. So I always have to have both, I have to be able to have the kind of analog and the digital working alongside. But other than that, I just kind of go for it. And my cat comes in and tells me when to take breaks.
They're very good at reminding you, like, oh, you need to stand up because you need to feed me.
Yes, well, basically, I like to think that it's some kind of selfless feline service. But of course, it is basically about, eating and, mostly their eating rather than mine. So whatever works. Yes.
They're useful in that way, but they do have their own motives.
Indeed. So. Indeed, they do. Yeah.
So obviously, the new book, Witchful Thinking, is about your personal practice. So what kind of prompted you to take this on as a project? Kind of since, like we talked about, this is kind of branching off from what you've published previously.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of those sort of nudge, urge things that I suppose maybe 10 years ago, I just really thought, I really want to write about kind of, my personal experiences and things that I feel have helped me and might help other people as well. And I really wanted to do it, but it was still, I still had that kind of hangover of, I'm still kind of in the broom closet. Those who know, those who would recognize a magical practitioner would spot it straight away. And I love that. But I certainly wasn't talking about it publicly, put it that way. And I think that for a lot of us of our generation, I think, we still have a foot in two kind of worlds that, the world of our parents' generation who would not talk about that. They were aware that that could lead to alienation or worse. And so that always just felt like, well, that's something you're private about. And I was fine with that for years, but then suddenly I just thought, I really do, so I kind of toyed with it for a bit. It just felt like something that needed to happen. In the meantime, I'd been doing quite a bit of radio work anyway, and I thought, maybe a way to sort of test the water with this is to sort of pitch a radio show called Rock and Roll Witch. It basically kind of brings together my two great loves, so rock and roll and magic. And because I feel like a lot of rock and roll is magical and has a cult at the heart of it, actually, and people are fine with that, that's okay. No one's been kind of massively persecuted for it. Well, although I say that, that's possibly not true. But anyway, that's another story. I know that Stevie Nicks did go through some persecution in the 80s. In fact, she actually never said she was a witch. She came over with the aesthetic and stuff, but she was always very careful for that reason, not to actually say the word or admit to it or come out of the broom closet. But there was a kind of hardline Christian group who did give her a lot of lot of problems. Mm-hmm. And she had to kind of change, or she felt compelled to change how she dressed for a while and how she acted and all the rest of it. She really felt quite threatened by them. So, you know, I'm very aware, and I certainly was aware of that when I wrote the book. I was not going to, you know, go there. I thought, if she doesn't want to go there, you know, I'm certainly not going to say, well, it doesn't matter what she says. I'm pretty sure she's a witch. I'm just not going to, you know, that's up to her, isn't it? So for that reason, you know, I was like, and then, you know, the show started and it was just such fun to do and to speak to other like-minded people as my guests, you know, like what you're doing now, and just such a lovely experience. And I thought, oh, this is, you know, this is going, I think this will be okay to maybe write about. And so I started, I was still kind of tinkering with the idea, but funnily enough, it's nice that it's coming out around Beltane, because at Beltane about 5 years ago, I was at the Jack in the Green Festival in Hastings, which is a very traditional celebration on May Day for Beltane, and very pagan and wild and fabulous. And I just had to go into a lovely shop called Hare and Hawthorne, which is very witchy, stationery shop, bought a notebook and a pen, and it just flooded out of me, the first draft of Witchful Thinking. Unstoppable. I've never written a book longhand before, ever. I mean, I wouldn't contemplate that. You know, I know I say I like writing longhand, but when it comes to writing a book, you know, you just, your hands get tired.
Right.
So, you know, generally speaking, using the laptop is a little bit easier, but it just wouldn't stop. It just flooded out of me through the pen onto the page, filled this notebook. And it was just such a joyful experience. And it wasn't lost on me that it happened at Beltane at this fertile, fabulous time, you know, just such a liminal time as well. Where certain things were coming through, and I just was like, oh gosh, that was a really lovely experience. I think I just have to do this and see where it takes me. So I worked up the draft, I pitched it to lots of publishers and agents, didn't really get anywhere for a while. Again, you know, the fact that I'd written lots of books about rock and roll didn't really, you know, cut any ice in the mind, body, spirit world, because they were like, well, you know, I mean, there are lots of new authors, but they sort of didn't know me, and you know, there's lots of people who want to write probably quite similar books and stuff, but I just thought I'd just keep going. And thankfully Llewellyn, who I adore, I've got lots of Llewellyns on my bookshelf, got back to me and were like, we're very interested in what you want to do, you know, tell us more and how we can work together. So off we went. And so what I wanted to achieve with it, really, because obviously, as we know, and you certainly know because I know you read a lot of these books for your podcast, and in your own time, no doubt, is that there's lots of quite similar witchy books out there. And so on my mind was like, is there room for, does the world need this? You know, you think about all those things, because when you put your words out there, you do make yourself a bit vulnerable, and you do have a responsibility to other people that you refer to, maybe, or, you know, it's complex. It's a complex thing. You know, I find I paint, and I love painting because I don't think about those things. I just like, here's my painting. I don't really mind if you don't like it. If you do like it, yay, great. Take from it what you will. But it's not going to ruin my day if you're not into it. Whereas with your words can so easily be misinterpreted, and it can actually do, you know, create problems, or, you know, we're constantly being misunderstood on social media. People read things, but not properly, and then they make their own conclusions. So it's become more than ever, I think, quite nerve-wracking for people who work with words, because we're very conscious of trying to make ourselves understood as simply as possible and put across what we want to say. And so I just thought, well, I need to write this from the heart. It's going to be a combination of, you know, experiences and things that I've grown up with, which was special to me. I mean, not everything, obviously, is quite a lot that I keep private. But there are also a lot of things that I wanted to share, that I felt were, you know, special to me, but also could apply to other people, I guess. And it was like, well, look, if I can do these things, we all can. It's just a case of, mm-hmm. you know, witchful thinking, which is basically about kind of creating a magical mindset, honing a magical mindset, so that the things we want to do are a little bit easier for mm-hmm. us and progressively easier, and we and that we view our lives every day in a magical way. And so that's kind of at the heart of the witchful thinking thing. At first I wanted to call it witchfulness, like mindfulness, but kind of like a witchy version. And witchful thinking kind of grew out of that. But it's not just a personal, certainly not a memoir. There's about 30,000 words worth I cut out, which were all kind of, you know, it's like, hang on, this is turning into an autobiography. And I don't think that's what Llewellyn wanted me to do. They still wanted it to be something that was like, you know, how to this, how to that, which is fine. So what else did I want to do with it? I suppose I wanted to kind of, it's not just for witches, I suppose, was important to me, because I feel like there's a lot of people who identify as witches just because maybe they watched a few TikTok videos and they, you know, they drink herbal tea and they've got five crystals and so now I'm a witch. And I know there's a lot of opprobrium in the pagan community about people who superficially take on the word witch, and I feel on the one hand it's wonderful to see the word being reclaimed in a positive way in lots of different ways, and that's mm-hmm. beautiful. And it means that we can all be ourselves in a much more safe way, openly. And how great is that? But on the other hand, I absolutely understand the feeling of, you know, hang on, people aren't taking this seriously. This is a very sacred thing. This is something many people have an awful lot for over centuries and been misunderstood and been ostracized and worse. So to then sort of not, you know, treat it with the gravitas that it deserves is troubling. So I sit on the fence between those two. So I feel mm-hmm. both of those things, I suppose. So witchful thinking was meant to say, look, you know, yes, this is for the witchy ones among us, but also it's about kind of making, you know, embracing the magic of every day for everyone, whether you are call yourself a witch or not. You know, there's magic in our lives all the time. It's about noticing it. It's about awareness. It's about embracing it and amplifying it, and seeing where that takes us. And, you know, that's for all of us. You know, that's in everybody's life, you know, whatever path they choose to walk. So that was important to me, because I thought if you're going to call yourself a witch, you know, that is a very serious and sacred thing. And, you know, I wanted to sort of basically communicate, you know, you can still be into a lot of these things without necessarily, you know, because you might not honestly be able to call yourself a witch, but you appreciate natural magic and you know. So it was about kind of communicating beyond the witchy community as well as within it, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
No, it does make sense.
And there are sort of, you know, there are kind of, I suppose I didn't want to make a spell book, because I think there are lots of those out there already that are far better than anything I could conjure up, no pun intended. But what I wanted to do was create the conditions, or help people create the conditions, where that kind of magical work comes a bit more smoothly as well. So it's sort of lots of things at the same time. And it's also about, you know, using our creativity to make magic and to manifest more effectively in our lives. You know, I think that our innate creativity is sometimes underestimated in how powerful, you know, we can work in quite a powerful way with it, I think.
Mm. We were talking earlier and I mentioned, like, the book reads like you're talking with a friend, like, let's sit down, have tea, we'll talk about witchy stuff. But then, like, your first suggestion in, like, further reading is like Agrippa. So clearly some research went into this book too. So what did that look like? Because so much of it is your personal practice and your experience, but then you do have a lot of end notes. And like, how did you kind of do the research to dovetail with what you wanted to talk about your own practice?
Well, yeah, I mean, the reason Agrippa's at the top there is mainly because his name begins with A. Right. And so it was an alphabetical order. But yes, I hear you. You know, obviously Agrippa, I mean, if you are a magical practitioner, I think, you know, you've got to know your Agrippa. You've got to have Agrippa in your on your magical library, or, you know, or sort of by the ebook or whatever. You can get translations of it as well now, much easier to work with. But that, you know, yes, I read very widely and always have. And, you know, it's a lifestyle and a spirituality and a study and, you know, it's everything. So Agrippa is obviously a very important character, Cat, in that pantheon. And also, you know, I was aware, it was quite interesting working like this, because, you know, when you're getting your thoughts down and you're writing your experiences or things that have worked for you, and remembering, you know, references to books that have been great, you know, or that you've referred to, when you're writing a book like this, you've got to reference absolutely everything, otherwise you can't use it. And so I was like, hang on. And they're like, well, where have you heard that then? You need to reference it. I was like, I don't know. I just kind of heard it somewhere. I just worked on it. So, but you've got to be absolutely stringent, quite rightly, to cite and reference absolutely everything. And if something is just something that you kind of heard along the way, just through being alive, and you can't cite it, then you can't use it. So I did have to kind of really be very stringent about that, and I am absolutely supportive of the process that says that you have to do that, of course. I've had my own work and words used without reference, and it's not great. So, you know, of course I would never do anything without crediting anyone, even if they died 500 years ago like Agrippa. But no, he is referred to a few times in the book, because I won't give too much away, but he is obviously a very, very important figure in the occult. So yeah, it's lots of things at the same time. There's also a lot of patriarchy smashing, as you may have noticed, between the pages, because, and I feel like, you can't really be a witch and not feel and notice those things. So there's a lot to say from that point of view. And of course, you know, that's a funny kind of link to bring. I just wanted to mention that before I forgot, really. But to sort of link that on from after talking about Agrippa is quite amusing, because, you know, he's a product of his time. And and those books are, you know, quite dismissive of women at times. And, you know, they can be cruel and stuff. But it's like what we were talking about earlier. We have to be able to read materials that are ultimately, you know, important, and be aware that there will be things in there that we don't agree with fundamentally, but we still have to be able to kind of read critically and intelligently, and say, okay, well, let's look at the context this was written in. Okay, I definitely don't agree with that. That's awful. But there's something here that you know, that is at the root of a lot of magic today, and it helps you to kind of link things together. That's why he you know, he's, I think that I'm rambling now, but yeah, I don't know if that does that answer your question.
No, it did answer my question, because I like I said, you know, like the tone, I think, belies probably how much work went on behind the scenes.
Oh, thank you. Oh, that's nice of you to say. Yeah, no, I do like to keep things kind of warm and irreverent, and that's just my style. And I'm really glad that you said it felt like sitting down with a cup of tea and having a witchy chat, because, you know, that's definitely where I was coming from. And I want to be able to sort of you know, have that kind of dialogue with the reader and share stuff that I think is positive and as I say, might help other people, or might inspire other people to sort of try similar things that might work for them. But at the same time, I think anyone writing in this subject, you know, really needs to kind of, I think, why wouldn't you want to do your homework and your stuff? You know, I think most people like yourself and me and people like us, they're naturally just going to want to learn as much as they possibly can about what went before, you know, who's, we're so lucky as well to have so much to read as well, because when you think about the amount of literature that was burned and that was destroyed, we're still piecing things together now, and so I think we naturally want to sort of voraciously read as much as we can, because maybe subconsciously we're aware of just how much was destroyed.
Well, and I think like you said, with the podcast and talking to a lot of different authors, a lot of people have kind of mentioned feeling like we're kind of in this new golden age of publishing about paganism and witchcraft and the occult. There's just so many books coming out and so much new scholarship, like not just like at this kind of like pop culture level, but also like deep academic work being done. Definitely. And there's just, you could literally spend 24 hours a day reading and not get to it all at this point. So
that's so true. And it's wonderful. It's like it's ready to be expressed through as many voices as possible. And that is an exciting time to be alive, for sure. Mm-hmm. We need it more than ever as well.
Yes. Yeah. I always, I am not the first person to comment on this. And I, like you said, I've read it elsewhere, but I cannot cite it at the moment. But it always seems like the occult and witchcraft has kind of a boom in hard times too. Like it's a solace for people in a lot of ways and an outlet for people who may feel powerless in that other areas.
Definitely. And I think when you think about what magic is, it's about having control over the things that seem to be sort of like threatening to take control of us. We want to take control back. That is important. You know, it's about taking the power back. And so it's, you know, that's such an interesting observation that you made, because it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, it's an opportunity to go, right, yeah, no, I'm not having that. That's not, no. What have I got within me? Actually, quite a lot of power, personal power. And that is definitely the way of the witch.
Yeah. Did you find, like, working on the book, that like you changed things about your practice or impacted your practice as you were writing?
Oh, that's a good question. It's hard to, you know, it feels like quite a while ago since I finished the book, because so I have to sort of cast my mind back, because it's really quite an incremental fluid thing, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we're changing all the time and we're developing. We should be, you know, we're growing. So I think inevitably my practice has sort of become, developed and become more honed and all the rest of it. Actually, mm-hmm. a change that has happened, you know, I've been a solitary practitioner for forever, really. And actually, very recently, shortly after handing in the book, that changed. So I'm now working with others. I suppose it just kind of reminded me, you never really know where magic's going to take you. And I suppose while I was writing it, and of course, you've got to be very conscious of who you're writing for. You're not writing for yourself. You know, you're writing for other people and hoping that they get something out of it. And so with that in mind, you know, I was very conscious of writing, you know, these are the things that I feel at this moment. These are the things that I feel to be true right now, but that's probably going to change. And, you know, how you feel right now is probably going to change. And that's okay. You have to give yourself the space to do that. And that's growth. That's what's supposed to happen. So I think I probably, in writing that, maybe went a little bit easier on myself with that in mind, just sort of saying to myself, you know, you are supposed to change. And I just was like, well, hang on, I'm a solitary witch, and now what, you know, you don't just sort of label yourself and that's you forever. Shift and change and grow, and that's beautiful, that's important. So I suppose that's something that springs to mind in terms of how things have maybe shifted through the process of writing.
Mm-hmm. So we touched on this a couple of times, or you've touched on it a couple of times, but what do you hope your readers take away from the book, and what do you feel like your responsibility was to them?
Well, I think, you know, when you're writing a book like this, you definitely do have a lot of responsibility. You're essentially advising people to try stuff, you know, try quite specific stuff. And, you know, of course, everybody has the choice to say, well, I don't really fancy doing that right now, or I don't agree with that, or whatever. But, you know, you have to the best of your abilities, do it in a way that is inclusive and, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Just sort of, as I say, you know, it's all very much from the heart. I'm sorry, I'm just flicking through just to see if I've got any kind of specific examples I wanted to share. But remind me the question. It was about the responsibility of the readers.
Like your responsibility to your readers. I mean, what, like when you were writing, what did you want them to take away, and what did you feel like your responsibility was to them?
Well, I suppose what I overall hope readers take away from, oh, sorry, my computer's doing an update. Hang on. Let me just... I'm glad this isn't live. Okay, can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Right, okay, all is well. I suppose, yeah, I wanted people to take away from the fact that magic is really everything. It's everything all the time. And my hope is that that people will kind of understand, I guess, that I'm sorry, my words are going a bit funny. Basically, my hope is that people will embrace magic in a very complete way, whether they identify as a witch or not, because it's so intrinsic and natural to us all. And by that, I mean not just thinking, oh, I'm going to do a ritual on the full moon or, you know, or when I need it. I mean, all day, every day, looking for the magic in everything that's around us. And it just, it's not just that it makes life better and more beautiful and more enjoyable. You know, that is the charmed life to which I refer in the subtitle, but also because that it, you know, a magical mindset, you know, witchful thinking, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. it's like a muscle that needs to be trained and used. And the more we do that, the more magical life becomes and the easier magical work becomes, because mm-hmm. we're already in that mode all the time. It could be in quite a subtle way, you know, it doesn't have to be totally full on all the time. But I think, you know, most people who are naturally sort of drawn to magical practice, that might be completely natural to them anyway. But I think some people, especially with the, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but sort of maybe the TikTok generation, it's all very fast and snappy, and there may be a possibility that people are treating it in a slightly more superficial way, in a not a very deep way or a very devout way. It's like kind of, you know, the Christian who only goes to church on Sundays or holy days, but the rest of the week isn't really thinking about it at all. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, it's kind of the same. So I suppose it is about kind of embracing that spirituality in a very complete way, because it's so life enhancing. That's the main thing, I guess. And also about kind of, you know, it is about self-empowerment. It is about, you know, patriarchy smashing and looking at that. It's also about kind of looking at, and this, again, this comes through, you know, patriarchal thinking, but it's about looking at how we see ourselves as women, or people who identify as women, how we change, how we age. And that was a really, for me, that there's a part of the book that does look into that quite a bit. And that's actually one of my favourite parts of the book. I speak to a couple of women who are really, really interesting on that subject, on menopause and changing and ageing. And it's such a taboo. It's still taboo. We're still kind of trained to try and be as young as possible. And so many otherwise very intelligent, brilliant women are completely distracted by trying to stay young, trying to stay sexy and fanciable and desirable. In the meantime, you know, I don't know, we could be using our energy and our time creatively and for the good of all, to use a magical phrase. So that was an important part of the book, and I hope that people take something positive away from that, just a kind of reframing of aging and how we talk about it. I don't even know if we really do talk about it enough. I think we're getting better at having conversations about things that were previously taboo, which is brilliant. We're definitely improving. You know, even in the past 5 years, we've come such a long way. But we can't let the ball drop. And so there's, you know, that's something that is an important part of the book for me, I would say.
Yeah, I really appreciated that too, because I mean, I'll be 50 this year. It's definitely on my mind.
50?
Yeah. Yes.
I don't believe you. Well, you are, you know, you do not look 50 at all. Oh, I would say.
Well, thank you.
You know, you don't even look 40. What is this witchcraft?
Perhaps witchcraft, yes. But I mean, it is on my mind a lot. And, you know, my friends are kind of all around the same age, so we're all kind of going through this at the same time. And just really now having these conversations as things come up, like, and realizing that none of us really had any preparation for this. Yeah. So,
no. So many women's issues just aren't talked about at all. And I think, you know, we're so many of us come late to even really knowing how to really look at menstruation. And no, it's we have to find so much out for ourselves. I'm so grateful for so many of the books that are out there that kind of help us do that. Mm-hmm. And give us a kind of helping hand through all this. And by the way, when I said, oh, you don't look 50, what I don't mean that if you did look 50, that would be a problem, because I meant genuinely you don't at all. It wasn't meant as a sort of hollow compliment. But the fact is, you know, I used to love, and still do, when I was little, I used to look at women with crow's feet and lines, laughter lines on their faces. Mm-hmm. And I just used to think they were the most beautiful things mm-hmm. I'd ever seen. And to the extent that I was like, how do I get those? How do I get laughter lines? And I remember sort of like scrunching up my face and sort of like, oh, my mum was like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, I'm trying to get crow's feet. Those beautiful crow. And she was like, and then, but you know, that's a, just a genuine, honest, unconditioned response of a child to seeing a woman with lines on her face, which I thought were genuinely beautiful. And what I also think is beautiful is the fact is that I couldn't get, I hadn't earned those. I had to live mm-hmm. a life of merriment and laughter and joy and positivity to get some of my own. And I thought, well, that's even more beautiful. So we just, it's a reframing of so many of these things that we need, because, you know, I think there's nothing cooler than a cool old lady who's at home with how old she is and at home with how she looks and how her, because, you know, those changes are, you know, often difficult, I know, and often painful, physically painful, apart from anything else. But we also have to find the beauty, because there is beauty and there are gifts, but they don't just come guaranteed. We have to embrace them and find them and not spend our whole time kind of concentrating on trying to look young or you know, doing stuff to ourselves that actually makes us look not like actual human beings anymore, but at least we don't have wrinkles. You know, it's gone so kind of crazy that I think we need to sort of learn how to listen to women who have been through the change and been through kind of aging, and listen to them, talk to them, because all too often as well, another problem that I know a lot of women feel once they go through menopause is they feel invisible. Mm-hmm. And this is at the very age we should be listening to them the most, because they have got all this life experience and wisdom. And so it's so topsy-turvy. We have to find our way back to a kind of balance.
Yeah. I think when, it, you know, kind of that section of the book, and then early in the book, you also mention that women is an inclusive word. And I thought that was so important, because I think, you know, a lot of witchcraft books that are marketed to women tend to have this like gate kept place.
Right.
And I really think that you know, you called out very early in the book. So, and along and talk about, you know, women who menstruate or women who don't, or women who can have babies or women who can't, or, you know, and I think that to me just like even made the book more enjoyable, because it was like, oh, this is an inclusive space we're talking about too. This isn't just, you know, women who were assigned female at birth. This is a bigger inclusive umbrella of folks. And I just appreciated that about the book.
Oh, thank you. No, I'm really pleased you noticed that and that you felt that. That's important to me, definitely. Because, yeah, to me, it's just, if you identify as female, that, you know, of course. I mean, but everyone is welcome to read this book, you know, in my opinion. But of course, it is naturally, it is geared towards people who identify as female. So, and that's my experience. So I feel like ultimately I can only really write truly from the heart, from my own experience. But everyone is welcome, of course. And I hope that men read it. You know, maybe that's an impossible dream, but I do hope that men will read this book as well. Because I think there are a lot of things that you know, a lot of perceptions that need to change that are so ingrained that I think sometimes people don't even realize they feel them, or so I think some of the things to about female aging or aging generally, you know, you can certainly apply them across the board, but also we need to, there's a lot of internalized misogyny as well. You know, it's not just chaps.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately, there are some perceptions that need changing. I'm not saying that my book is the magic bullet to do that, but I kind of, you know.
Maybe it's a good chink in that wall, breaking down that wall. So
I hope so. I really hope so, yeah.
Okay. So I have a last question for you, but before we get there, do you want to talk about any upcoming projects or let people know where they can get in touch with you?
Upcoming projects, well, I suppose there's the Art of Punk book that I talked about. I'm not quite sure when that's coming out, but maybe don't worry about that. But I can, yes, my show Rock and Roll Witch is on Soho Radio every month. And so if you look up SohoRadioLondon.com, And look up Rock and Roll Witch. You will find all previous shows there and show details. So if anyone wants to listen to that, then you know, they'd be very welcome. And other than that, if they want to get hold of Witchful Thinking, you can pre-order it via the Llewellyn Worldwide website. Mm. And there's a link on there. It's quite easy to find. And if they want to get in touch with me, I'm on Instagram. And I've got a Facebook page, which is called... Well, there's the Rock and Roll Witch on Soho Radio Facebook page. And there's Zoe Howe Books and Art and Rock and Roll. I can't remember the name of my own Facebook page. I don't use Facebook very often. But, yeah, you know, the usual channels, basically. Yes. Twitter, you know, all that. So good vibes only, please.
I'll make sure all that's in the show notes for people who want to find that in your website. And I think a lot of that stuff is on your website, too. So
yes, it is. Yes, absolutely.
Great. Okay, so our last question is, and you mentioned when we were emailing back and forth that you were also a Scorpio, so I'm sure you will appreciate this, is a way to get to those like kind of topics we're not supposed to talk about in polite company. Although honestly, I've said this a couple times, the whole podcast is a little bit like that, but so I'm going to roll this fancy metal die. And depending on what number we get, that's what the question will come from. So the topics are death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I roll a six, you get to pick which of those five you would like.
Okay.
Three, religion.
Oh.
We kind of talked a lot about religion, but if you were going to set up your own canon of sainted writers, who would your patron saint be? And because it's you, and I know you have multiple talents, who would you include as your artist and your musician?
Well, this is easy, actually, because I would say that the patron saint I would nominate would be the writer and witch Marianne Weinstein. Do you know her?
I have heard of her, but I haven't read any of her.
She's such a special person, and she's on the other side now. She died a few years ago, but she really is my North Star. And when I first started reading witch, well, I was very fortunate because my mum had lots of kind of occult books on mm-hmm. the shelf anyway, sort of grew up with them around. So I didn't have to look very far, and I'm very aware that a lot of people didn't have that experience. So I feel very privileged. But when I kind of was out in the world on my own, I remember finding a book of Marianne Weinstein's called Positive Magic in a secondhand bookshop. And it was just like, you know, it's probably the wrong word to use, but it was like a Bible to me. I took it with me everywhere. I wrapped it in silver wrapping paper so that I could read it on public transport without arousing suspicion. And, you know, so ever since then, I just felt like Marianne Weinstein and her writing on positive magic. She was called the positive witch or the positive the ethics witch, she called herself. And she was also a comedian as well. So she had a radio show called Marianne's Cauldron in the 60s. So she was just like, for me, Marianne would be the patron saint. I could talk about her all night and I won't. So
maybe there's a good book topic for you in there.
You know what? I would love to write her biography. But she was a New York witch, and I sort of feel like a New Yorker or at least an American witch should do it. But, you know, maybe it'll be like the Slits. It's like, no one's doing this. Oh God, I'll just do it. You
know? Yeah, they say write the book you want to see on the shelf. So
that is exactly right. That was totally my motivation with the Slits. So maybe I should do it with the Marianne book as well. I would love that. Anyway, massive tangent. Sorry about that. So yeah, Marianne, Saint Marianne. Oh, just love her so much. And sidebar, if you look her up on YouTube, she was so ahead of her time. She was one of the first witches to use YouTube when it was a new platform. She was already in her 60s, I think. And she just made loads of really lovely magical videos at turns of the wheel. And they all feature like her menagerie of familiars, and there's dogs and cats everywhere and like wearing little hats. And she's hilarious, but just...
I'll find some links and put them in the show notes so people can check them out, because that sounds great.
I would love more people to hear the Marianne gospel, St. Marianne's gospel. And so the artist, so was it an artist I have?
An artist and a musician, yeah.
An artist and a musician. So, I would say, that's a difficult one, because I feel that many artists are actually magical practitioners, whether they necessarily identify publicly that way or not, because to me, making art is like instant manifestation. You know, once there was nothing, then there was something. You know, that is a magical act. And the fact, just the method of making art puts you in the flow state, doesn't it? And mm-hmm. that is such a key place to be if you want to. That's where magic lives. So, yeah, that's difficult. I've got two that spring to mind.
We'll let you have two.
Oh, really? let's go for Aethel Cahoon, who actually a friend of mine wrote a wonderful book on. You may know Dr. Amy Hale. You should get her on your show, actually. She's fabulous. And she wrote a brilliant book about the art and life of Aethel Cahoon, who lived in Cornwall. She was a surrealist. But she was kind of an outlier as well. I mean, all surrealists are kind of outliers, but she was an outlier. Yeah, you know, she was the ultimate outsider, and very much combined the occult with her art. So I would say Aethel, definitely. There's another one as well, but, you know, probably have to be Dali, actually. He was very magical, I think. Oh, no, Austin Osman Spare. What am I thinking? We've got to have Austin.
Okay.
Austin Osman Spare, yeah. Who was a great... Do you know Austin Osman Spare? Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course you do. Made lots of amazing magical art. Very interesting guy. And he's got actually a wonderful biography that you may have read by Phil Baker.
Yeah, it's on my never-ending to-be-read pile, but I haven't found it yet.
Well, you're going to love it. I'm envious of you because you haven't read it yet. You're going to, it's a wonderful book. So yeah, big fan of Phil Baker's biography of Austin Osman Spare. So two artists, and was it a musician?
Musician, yeah.
It's got to be Stevie Nicks.
That's fair.
It's got to be Stevie. Yeah, she is, you know, rock's witchy wise woman. And, you know, I feel like, you know, she is obviously a magical being. But I felt she was kind of underestimated as a creative spirit. I think certainly in the 70s, she was just sort of seen as this kind of glamorous, magical sex symbol in Fleetwood Mac. And, you know, she wasn't taken as seriously as the other songwriters in the band. Actually, mm-hmm. I feel like now there's a bit of a reckoning, a bit of a reconsideration of Stevie. And she's this kind of like this wise elder of rock and roll. She's fabulous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't think I know a witch who doesn't like at least one Stevie song. Like, I don't think
What's
I've
your
met
favorite?
Oh, I really love Rhiannon. I think it may be one of my favorites. But the one that like the one Fleetwood Mac Stevie Nicks song that I can't listen to and not cry is Landslide. Both my parents have passed, and that song just gets me every single time. So yeah,
so
I have to skip it. Like if I'm driving, I can't listen to it in the car.
Yes, and Silver Springs as well. I find mm-hmm. Silver Springs very moving as well. But no, Landslide, I completely, especially with the association. Yeah, totally. She's an incredibly special songwriter and a very special person. I think Stevie Nicks.
Yeah. That's
perfect. We're lucky to have her.
I like your pantheon.
Thank you very much. It's a very inadvertently mostly female pantheon, apart from Austin Osman Spare, isn't it?
It's not surprising.
No, it's not. It doesn't, apropos of nothing, you know, it doesn't make any difference. Yeah. Really, it's just that it's all good. But yeah. Thank you for asking. I like the sound of this this pantheon very much.
Yeah, me too. Well, I like the idea. You know, I'm so glad we still have Stevie with us, but like those who have passed, like, you know, the mighty dead, you know, I think influence our magic too. So
very much so. I think that's such a good point. And, you know, I think that's one of the lovely, exciting things I think about magic is that when you are working magic, you feel part of a continuum as well, don't mm-hmm. you? You feel like you are continuing something and you're part of something that goes back and back and back and forwards in time. And, you know, I love the sense that, you know, I know a lot of people do say it in their rituals as well. I think Selena Fox is very good at acknowledging that you know, we are part of something that goes forwards and backwards in time. Mm-hmm. And every time we light the bale fire or, you know, or whatever, we're connecting with every magical worker who did the same in centuries past, and you know, and also across time now, you know, across mm-hmm. space now. That's one of the things I love about the turns of the wheel. I know that even if I'm just doing a very small ritual, it is connecting with all of the other people who are doing the same right at that moment. And mm-hmm. I just think that is so beautiful.
Yeah, that's such a great note to end on. Zoe, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been such a wonderful conversation, and I hope that we get to have another one soon.
Oh, yes, me too. I've had such a lovely time talking to you. Thank you very much for inviting me on your podcast, and I'm really, really thrilled to meet you.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Kaifel Agostini, who also designed our logo. Our music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew K. End, licensed from Pixabay. You can find transcripts and all our previous episodes at witchlitpod.com and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at witchlitpod. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow or subscribe and consider giving us a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps other witches find the show. Thanks for listening and for reading Witchy.